and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina and strong supporter of President Trump, urged him today to temporarily reopen the government to allow for talks that could satisfy his demand for a border wall. Anger is mounting as hundreds of thousands of federal employees are going without pay, and polls show that most Americans don't want a border wall, and most blame Trump for the longest government shutdown in history. Next, National Security Advisor John Bolton asked the Pentagon last year to draw up plans to attack Iran, and senior Pentagon officials are voicing deepening fear that he could precipitate a conflict with that country at a time when the U.S. presence in the Middle East is declining. And President Trump said that he would, quote, devastate Turkey economically, unquote, if it attacks the Kurds when the U.S. pulls its troops out of Syria. Then, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, a Democrat from Hawaii, announced her candidacy for president on Saturday. Gabbard is a decorated veteran of the Iraq War and is a strong proponent of peace issues. She's also the first American Samoan and the first Hindu to be elected to Congress. Pundits believe she may draw support away from Bernie Sanders, but she also has been subject to intense criticism over her record on LGBTQ rights. And then today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And finally, British Prime Minister Theresa May traveled around the country to drum up support ahead of Tuesday's critical parliamentary vote on Brexit. She told voters in Northern England that if Parliament votes down the Brexit deal, there will be no alternative and it will paralyze British politics and likely lead to no Brexit. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the government shutdown. Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina and strong supporter of President Trump, urged him today to temporarily reopen the government to allow for talks that could satisfy his demand for a border wall. Anger is mounting as hundreds of thousands of federal employees are going without pay, and polls show that most Americans don't want a border wall, and most blame President Trump for the longest government shutdown in history. We're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance, and you can check out their work at popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Kevin.
Hey, great to talk to you guys.
I was surprised that virtually as soon as the words came out of Lindsey Graham's mouth, Donald Trump said, that's not happening. So it looks like the White House has backed itself into a corner and they're back at square one. How does or can Donald Trump get out of this?
He has backed himself into a corner. He made that mistake right from the beginning with that meeting with Pelosi and Schumer, where he took blame or credit for the shutdown that was coming. And now it's here. And the public's blaming him because he took credit for it. So I don't see an easy way out. You know, he was offered a way out. The Democrats are smart to pass that legislation that the Republicans had unanimously approved, and then McConnell refused to consider it. And Trump said, I can't do that because I'll look foolish. Well, every day this goes longer, he looks more foolish. Polls are against him. Polls don't want the border wall. Polls don't blame him for the shutdown. This is a victory for the Democrats.
Yeah, I think it is a victory for the Democrats. And the polls show that most Americans don't want this border wall, and he's still willing to go to the mat for it.
There is one other element of this, though, and I saw this, I believe it was in the New York Times yesterday. Majority opposes Trump on the border wall, but the other part of the poll is the support for the wall is actually growing, meaning among Trump supporters, not 100% of them felt the wall was really the thing. Maybe a whole bunch of them did, but not all of them. But at least within some part of the population, his agitation around the wall following his trip to the border is, in fact, increasing. Again, in some part of the population, it's not the majority, increasing support for the wall.
Well, but those kind of polls, Brian, are a snapshot in time. And this is after a nationally televised speech by Trump, his first and only ever national speech, a trip to the border. You know, he's really doing his best to pump up the media on support for his wall, and he made a marginal improvement, but that'll be temporary because the response to that you're seeing also from border populations saying there's no crisis here. What are we talking about? This is people are seeing it's a manufactured crisis. He wanted to declare a national emergency, but there's no national emergency. And so he's backing off of that. And the Democrats are in the position of saying, we are not going to give in to President Trump holding us hostage. Because they've given on this hostage situation, then what will stop Trump from doing that again? We have the debt limit coming up in March. That may get extended into July or August. And so we'll have the debt limit fight. Remember what those were like when led to kind of shutdowns? The Democrats are not giving up. Then we have all these subpoena battles with all the oversight that's coming from the House over Trump and his administration. And those are going to be fights too. So the Democrats really cannot give in to this hostage-taking approach that President Trump is using. And so they're going to stand tough. And so Trump is in a situation of how does he get out of looking stupid? And I don't see an easy way out. And so this is going to drag on until Trump faces the reality that he has to. Already you're seeing on the Senate side, Republicans starting to break away from Trump.
Yes.
That's starting to build. You're not seeing that on the Democrat side. Democrats are hanging together. And so they're staying unified, but you're seeing division among Republicans. This is a win for the Democrats. And in the end, I don't see any way but for the hostage crisis to end and for Trump to stop holding the federal government hostage.
Federal workers, or at least some of them, are suing Donald Trump, accusing him of violating the 13th Amendment because these workers are compelled to work, but they're not compelled. The government's not compelled to pay them right now. So they're working without pay. Of course, the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery and involuntary servitude in the aftermath of the Civil War, I should say parenthetically, except for prisoners.
Right.
It makes this kind of thing illegal. What about that lawsuit, Kevin Zeese?
Well, you know, the lawsuit really, I don't know how that lawsuit's going to go. I think it's kind of shaky, but I do think it shows serious and unhappiness among federal workers. And think of who these federal workers are. These are FBI. These are Homeland Security. These are Department of Justice. These are air traffic controllers. These are the mainstay that a government needs to keep its control. If we start to see mass protests, as we've seen throughout the Trump presidency and the Obama presidency, continue to escalate, if Yellow Vest comes to the United States and Homeland Security is pissed off at Trump, you know, Brian, when we protest in Washington, D.C., it's Homeland Security that is the force that's out handling protests. And Trump is off the people he needs to keep control. So he's not only is he shutting down only a portion of the government, the portion he's shutting down is essentially the security state,
yeah,
which is so essential for him to keep power.
It is, and it's the part of the security state that most Americans interact with.
A lot of TSA employees mm-hmm. at the airport are calling in sick right now, Kevin Zeese. A lot of them, they don't want to work without pay. Let's do a hypothetical. Instead of going on strike, which is not legal, let's say they just all got sick tomorrow and all called in sick, and no airplane could take off. The airport shut down. Don't you think we'd have an end to the government shutdown almost immediately?
Yes, I think then that would be an incredibly powerful move that would teach the people of the United States that they actually have the power. Refusal to participate, refusal to give in to this kind of stress, this kind of pressure is the power people have they don't realize. If we start to see a strike like that end the shutdown, people will realize the power of the general strike, and who knows where that develops. So this is a great benefit, I think, for the popular movement to recognize their power. And we've only gone through one lost paycheck so far. If we go into a second lost paycheck, you look at the reality of workers in the United States. These are decently paid workers, these federal employees. But still, they have high rents. They have high mortgages. They have tuition for their kids. They have debts they have to pay. You know, the U.S. workers cannot survive a $500 surprise expense. How they are living on the edge. Even a middle-class worker like these federal workers cannot handle missing a month of pay.
Yeah, if you miss one paycheck, yeah, that's a pinch. If you miss one paycheck, that hurts. If you miss two paychecks, you don't make your mortgage.
Huge number of Americans who are homeless workers, people
yes.
who go to work every day. Again, I think it's a better strategy to, quote, have a sick out which is the same thing as a strike rather than a lawsuit. I'm looking at the Washington Post about how these 13th Amendment lawsuits fare. Listen to this one, and you'll know about this, Kevin. You're an attorney. For example, the Supreme Court held in 1988 that pushing mentally disabled men to work on a farm for no wages by threat of institutionalization did not amount to involuntary servitude because, quote, psychological coercion, close quote, isn't covered under the amendment. That's the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's when it was a way more liberal 1988 than it is today. Yeah, the courts, I understand the lawsuit. The workers are right to file the lawsuit. But guess what, everybody? If you really want action, have a sick out.
That's right.
And again, a sick out, if you're not feeling well, it's not illegal to all be sick at the same time. Somebody might construe that to be a wildcat strike. But from my point of view, it would just be like strange, but not unheard of that everybody got sick at the same time.
I think that would be a very smart move for workers to take that on. And if workers do it without their union support, that's fine too. I think that's important for workers to stand up for their own rights. That's what we're seeing in those West Virginia teacher strikes. That's what we're seeing in the Yellow Vest movement, workers going beyond their unions and standing up for their own rights. These workers, I think, if you go another 2 weeks without pay, you're going to see that kind of, because these lawsuits, you're right, are not the avenue, but they do show the anger. And on the other hand, if Trump were to take the emergency route, I think he'd lose that lawsuit on that ground, and I think that's why he's backing off it, because he knows that he would lose that lawsuit, because he's on very shaky ground declaring an emergency when there's no real emergency at all. So the courts, I think, for the workers are not very solid, but the courts will prevent Trump from the emergency route, again, keeping Trump trapped in that corner. He has no choice, if he wants to end this, to take the kind of approach Lindsey Graham is talking. Lindsey Graham is giving him good advice. I don't agree with Lindsey Graham very often, but Lindsey Graham is giving him good advice. End the shutdown, negotiate, and if that doesn't work, then take an escalation down the road. But you're losing. Right now, he's in a losing playing field, needs to get off it and stop making the workers into hostages, because that's what they are. The gun is pointed at their head. And that's not going to, the Democrats cannot give in to hostage taking, because there's a lot of fights coming up in this next year over oversight, over the budget, over the debt ceiling, that the Democrats, if they give in this hostage taking, Trump will use it again. They've got to stand against it, and Trump has no choice but to give in.
We will end it there. That was the voice of Kevin Zeese, who joined us from Baltimore. Kevin is the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance, and you can check out their important work at popularresistance.org. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
National Security Advisor John Bolton asked the Pentagon last year to draw up plans to attack Iran, and senior Pentagon officials are voicing deepening fear that he could precipitate a conflict with that country at a time when the U.S. presence in the Middle East is declining. And President Trump said that he would, quote, devastate Turkey economically, unquote, if it attacks the Kurds when the U.S. pulls its troops out of Syria. We're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Welcome back, Mohammed.
Thank you very much for inviting me on the show.
We're happy to have you. Mohammed, this is big news here in the United States. Tell us what the reaction is in Iran.
Well, the reaction really hasn't been all that significant. It's not been on the front page of any of the major newspapers that I've seen, and none of the key websites have made anything big out of it. We've heard of American threats for so many years and all options being on the table from so many presidents, and so many secretaries of state and defense officials in the United States that I think most people are used to it. I don't think anyone takes it very seriously, largely because the feeling in Iran is that the Americans know quite well that Iran's defense capabilities are pretty significant, and that if there is any strike on behalf of the Americans, there will be a very strong reply, and that would create havoc in the Persian Gulf. That could raise the price of oil substantially, even the smallest conflict. And the global economy is already doing very poorly. And American forces are vulnerable across the region. Iran has strong allies in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Afghanistan. So I don't think that the Americans are looking for trouble, and I don't think that people in Iran and decision makers feel that the Americans are really looking for trouble.
Well, it's very interesting to me that you say that, because that's what we're hearing from the Pentagon, of all places, that the Pentagon, at least the military people at the Pentagon, are not at all interested in fighting the Iranians, that this is not just a civilian idea, but it's specific to John Bolton, that it's John Bolton pushing this notion that there's going to be a conflict with Iran, and nobody else is talking about it.
I agree. I don't even think, I mean, I don't know Bolton, but I don't even think Bolton really, truly, if he's sane, that he seriously contemplates attacking Iran. And maybe they are leaking this in order to create some sort of concern or fear in Iran, to make Iran give some sort of concession. I don't know. But, the Americans know quite well how capable Iran is. And it's not just the military, but I'm sure that Bolton himself is well informed of Iranian capabilities. And it's sort of like what Trump is saying to Turkey, threatening Turkey with economic devastation. This sort of bluster is not going to work with Turkey, and it's even more so with Iran. And that's one of the characteristics of this administration. They talk very big, although I do recognize that Trump is a very different sort of political animal than Bolton. But I still don't think that anyone here takes Bolton seriously, and I don't think that Bolton himself is probably serious about any form of confrontation.
The Wall Street Journal, John, reported that the Pentagon, although, quote, alarmed over Bolton's demand for actionable plans, contingency plans for military strikes against Iran, and Mattis said that apparently, according to these reports, that he was opposed to it. And he, of course, was not only the Secretary of Defense, but a general, a Marine general, and an important figure within the uniformed officer corps in the Pentagon. But nonetheless, according to this Wall Street Journal, the Pentagon did deliver general options to the National Security Council, including cross-border airstrikes on Iranian military facility that would have been mostly symbolic. And then, of course, they're saying the Pentagon, including Mattis, adamantly opposed this. I wondered whether the leak had to do with the growing opposition inside the Pentagon to Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, you had Mattis resign after Trump announced that he wanted to withdraw the U.S. troops from Syria and cut the number of troops in Afghanistan to half. Mattis resigned quickly. He offered a sort of a principled, so to speak, opposition to Trump's positions in his resignation letter. He basically said, I'm resigning because I have policy differences with you on a number of issues, including Russia and China. I wonder whether the Pentagon is leaking this because they're getting back at Trump. Trump is a kind of unusual political animal, as Mohammed Mirandi is telling us, and we know that. John Bolton, too, is an extremist.
Mm-hmm.
Bolton is serving at the pleasure of Trump. The two of them going rogue, that's what the impression would be, that they're going rogue, that they're not doing this in a coordinated way, and thus putting the country on a path towards a war that would be very bad for the United States, because, as Mohammed Mirandi is also pointing out, Iran is not Iraq, and Iran is not Somalia, and Iran is not Libya. Iran's a big country with a big military. Anyway, what do you think about that, Mohammed?
It's hard to say. It could actually be a leak in with the sort of significance that you attach to it, but it could also be something else. And remember, Bolton threatened Iran and said he sort of put Iran on notice, sort of like General Flynn did when he first, during the first days of the new administration. Bolton, during that period, threatened Iran. And almost immediately after threatening Iran, these mortars struck areas near American facilities, or the American consulate, for example. And I don't know who fired those mortars. They could have been friends of Iran, but I think it could have been interpreted in Washington as a humiliation of Bolton, because Bolton had threatened Iran, and then almost immediately afterwards, these mortars were fired, basically telling in sending a message, perhaps in the eyes of Washington, that we don't take you seriously. So Bolton may have felt humiliated and wanted a way to show his, I don't know, his masculine side or to show his strength. It's hard to say where this comes from, whether the military leaked it, whether someone close to Bolton leaked it. But the point is that the very fact that right after Bolton's statement in September, these mortars were fired, shows that the other side or Iran's friends or allies don't take Bolton seriously because they recognize that there is a sort of balance of terror in the region. And this is what prevents the United States military from being used against Iran. If there are airstrikes on Iran, then I think American facilities immediately will be hit back and everyone loses. So this balance, I think, has been established, and the region is so sensitive because of the oil installations, the gas installations, and the fact that all of the critical facilities of Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and others are on the Persian Gulf shore, that it's really, in my opinion, inconceivable for the Americans to seriously contemplate any military confrontation with Iran.
Mohammed, we've got about a minute and a half left. I want to turn to Syria. This spat between the United States and Turkey seems to be growing worse, with Erdogan saying now that he doesn't care if the U.S. stays or goes. He still recognizes the YPG as a terrorist group. And of course, the YPG is the closest U.S. ally in Syria. Assuming that the U.S. does withdraw, what does that do to the balance of power inside Syria?
Well, the very fact that the Americans entered Syria in the first place strengthened the Syrian government, ironically, because they pushed Turkey towards Iran as a result. By empowering these Kurdish groups, Turkey moved closer to Iran. And of course, Iran is close to Syria. And because of the instability that the Turks feel exists in their southern border and the threat that it has to their security, they're now looking for a way out. So on the American occupation has, in a very strange way, brought the interests of Syria and Turkey closer to each other. Both want the Americans out. And then on the other hand, now that the Americans have said they want to go, the Kurds are being forced to move towards Syria because they know that they can't trust the Americans and they don't like the Kurds. So they're also helping Syria today regain their sovereignty. Turkey knows that it cannot invade Syria because it would be economically very painful for them, and they're not in a very good position. So on the whole, while there's going to be a long road ahead, I think this whole occupation and withdrawal, or this beginning of the withdrawal, is actually strengthening Syria and moving Turkey even closer to Iran.
We will leave it there. That was the voice of Dr. Mohammed Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, a Democrat from Hawaii, announced her candidacy for president on Saturday. Gabbard is a decorated veteran of the Iraq War and is a strong proponent of peace issues. She's also the first American Samoan and the first Hindu to be elected to Congress. Pundits believe she may draw support away from Bernie Sanders, but she has also been subject to intense criticism over her record on LGBTQ rights. We're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He is one of the producers of this show and a Sputnik News analyst. Welcome back, Walter.
Happy to be here.
Tulsi Gabbard, Walter, to me, is one of the most fascinating people running for Congress this year. Let's tackle this LGBTQ issue first. About a decade and a half ago, she worked for her father, who is a Hawaii state senator. Her father is very conservative. He's been reported to be homophobic, or at least used to be homophobic, and he subscribed to this debunked theory of conversion therapy. Now, Tulsi Gabbard, in the interim, has come out and said that this was a terrible mistake. In fact, she issued a statement to CNN. She says here, "I regret the positions I took in the past and the things I said. I'm grateful to those in the LGBTQ plus community who have shared their aloha with me throughout my personal journey." The LGBTQ community has given her 100% positive ratings in Congress. So it looks like she's put her money where her mouth is. Do you think this is going to be a problem for her as she enters the presidential primaries?
I think there are two main reasons why people are talking about Tulsi Gabbard after her announcement. I mean, one, people are excited about her very unique position on foreign policy issues and military issues, which is unlike maybe any other member of Congress, with perhaps one or two exceptions, is, you know, a pretty consistent opponent of U.S. militarism and wars abroad. And so people who are looking for something new in politics, people who are sick of hearing the same old tired thing about, you know, endless war and, you know, the necessity to engage in endless war to, quote unquote, keep America safe. People are, you know, on the positive end, excited about those positions. And then the main thing that's been covered in the media today and part of yesterday, too, is her record on LGBTQ equality. And so I think there are sort of two pieces of that to parse out. One is sort of where she comes from personally, where, you know, you laid out her father's position as sort of this prominent, you know, like bigoted anti-LGBTQ politician who, you know, promotes all these vile things. And so, you know, she was raised in that environment, was obviously introduced into politics in that environment. And certainly that's reflected in a lot of the statements that she made when she was younger. And then there's the other piece of Tulsi Gabbard as a public figure and as a political leader. And I think in that regard, she's basically the same as, say, you know, 90% of politicians, you know, over the course of the past 10 or 15 years, where, you know, you start with what was the default position in society, which was bigotry, which was homophobia. And then as a consequence of this mass movement that developed, you know, over the course of many decades, I mean, especially since the Stonewall Rebellion, you know, there is like this explosion of the LGBTQ movement that began to score major, major victories and totally turn the tide of public opinion. And as a consequence, the politicians had to switch their position. And Tulsi Gabbard is one of many people who did that.
This is what Gabbard said about her intervention in the campaign. There is one main issue that is central to the rest, and that is the issue of war and peace. Gabbard has called for the U.S. to be out of Syria. She, in fact, believed that the armed opposition to the Assad government was reactionary, that it was based on al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda-type political organizations. She also said these words back in 2015, and this is why I think another reason why the military-industrial complex and the neocon political orientation, which is very right-wing interventionist military and foreign policy position, is in fact no longer like one wing of the establishment, but the dominant consensus position, why they won't allow her actually to be considered a credible candidate. Here's what she tweeted. Al-Qaeda attacked us on 9/11 and must be defeated. Obama won't bomb them in Syria. Putin did. That would indicate that if the priority of the war on terror was the defeat of Al-Qaeda everywhere, including in Syria, the U.S. should be doing what the Russians were doing at that time, which was bombing these forces. And instead, the Obama administration, Hillary Clinton earlier, were sort of undifferentiating. The armed opposition were treated all as freedom fighters as long as they were against the Assad government and the Obama administration. But particularly Hillary Clinton had the mantra, and then John Kerry, Assad must go, Assad must go. Like the principal problem in Syria was not al-Qaeda or right. al-Nusra. It was the Assad government. It seems to me that Tulsi Gabbard tweeting like Putin did the right thing and Obama didn't, like that's the kiss of death, especially now given the political environment.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, there are certain things that you're just not allowed to say as a politician, as somebody who's at the highest levels of the U.S. government, a government that has, you know, as it's in its essence, right, like a core characteristic of what the United States is in the world is it's the hegemon, right? I mean, they have, you know, I think over 1,000 military bases by some estimates in 140 countries around the world. You know, this is a core component of this society and of the political class that runs it. And so because she sort of falls outside of the acceptable range of opinion on foreign policy, which is always a much more constricted range of acceptable opinion than there is on domestic issues, she's sort of considered to be this fanatic or extremist or somebody with views that are just completely indefensible. But I think that the population of the United States would disagree with that. You know, even though we're subjected to a lot of misinformation about what's really going on in Syria, I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, the people fighting against the government of Bashar al-Assad, whatever you think of Bashar al-Assad, are fighting to impose a theocracy.
I think she could talk her way out of that because she's one of the most down-the-line opponents of regime change in Syria that exist in Congress. She's worked with libertarian Republicans to reintroduce the War Powers Act, to try to curtail the president's ability to send troops overseas. She's called for U.S. recognition of the Assad regime, withdrawal of troops. So I think she may be able to talk her way through that unfortunate tweet.
But there's another part to it. In 2017, she actually went to Syria and met with Bashar al-Assad.
Yes, she did.
Now, again, because the consensus position is what it is, the neocons are now the dominant strain of American foreign policy, that too is considered a red line of sorts politically. When she did that, the Washington Post, a Washington Post columnist actually labeled Tulsi Gabbard Assad's mouthpiece in Washington. I mean, you can't get like a worse label. But again, you know, when you think back about it, what is unacceptable now used to be very acceptable. In fact, the Bashar al-Assad's, the replacement of his father, Hafez al-Assad, same government in essence. It's the Ba'athist government, the Ba'athist regime. In 1991, George H.W. Bush was working with the Assad government
very closely
in the war against Iraq during 1991. I mean, they were allies. Just like it used to be okay to talk to the Russian president or the Soviet president or the Syrian president. Nowadays, if you go and actually just have a meeting with them, you're the mouthpiece, the apologist. I mean, it's this kind of hysteria, witch hunting sort of tyranny that makes a speech impossible.
And isn't Syria a sovereign country? I mean, Tulsi Gabbard isn't the person who's going to choose who's the legitimate representative of the Syrian people to meet with. You know what I mean? I mean, the U.S. government did that. They tried to set up all these, you know, puppet transitional administrations. But I mean, the fact of the matter is that Syria is a self-determining country. And it's not up to Tulsi Gabbard or any other U.S. politician to determine who the leader of that country is. And so if you want to do, you know, diplomacy, as is your right to as an elected member of Congress, who else do people think that Tulsi Gabbard should have met with?
Tulsi Gabbard is the first Samoan to run for president of the United States. She's a Hindu. She not only had a bad position, a reactionary position on LGBTQ issues as a younger person, she also was a reactionary on women's right to choose, on abortion rights. She's also taken back that position, and she now has from Planned Parenthood a 100% voting rating in Congress. But there is another element of Tulsi Gabbard that I want to touch on, Walter, really quickly, which is she also supported Trump's a ban on Muslims or people from some Muslim countries, including Syria. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, I think it was a shameful position to take. And it reflects a political alliance, and whether it's an ideological alliance or an alliance of convenience is something to be debated. But between her and basically the forces supportive of the current Indian government, which is a right-wing Hindu nationalist government, and because of the dynamics of Indian politics, and especially post-colonial Indian politics, that takes on a virulently anti-Muslim character. So, you know, she's in relationship with all those different political forces. And also, in terms of her public pronouncements about terrorism and safety, does actually echo some pro-war talking points about sort of the danger of extremism. But I think at the end of the day, that doesn't translate into the sort of same type of neoconservative foreign policy positions that, you know, Islamophobia generally does in U.S. politics.
No, indeed. I think it's important that we're having an objective evaluation of Tulsi Gabbard and her different positions. Again, the U.S. mainstream establishment, the neocon establishment, they're going to try to trash and destroy Tulsi Gabbard now as a candidate.
Yes, they will.
Not because of her earlier reactionary positions or even her bad position on Syrian refugees. They're going to do it because she's saying the U.S. should not be a military colossus. It shouldn't be going to endless war. That's going to be the red line for the establishment. We need to have an objective assessment of these politicians, including the progressive ones with all of their contradictory positions.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Maine. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of the new book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers' Unions, and Public Education. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Welcome back, Bill.
Good to hear your voices.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And we're excited to talk about the Los Angeles teacher strike today. Teachers were supposed to go on strike on Thursday. They decided to postpone it until today, hoping that some kind of progress could be made in contract talks. No progress was made, and 31,000 teachers and associated employees went on strike today in the country's second largest school district.
It's a very exciting moment for those of us who care about public education. This is a massive walkout, and I think it's important that your listeners know the facts about what's going on. You're right, 31,000 teachers walked out after long, long, long negotiations that went nowhere. And 10 schools, the support staff, walked out in a sympathy strike. So this is a very important development. It continues what we've talked about a lot, which is the Chicago teacher strike of half a decade ago, and then the wildcat strikes throughout the red states in the spring and early summer. So I think we should be encouraged by this, because this is teachers standing up, not just for wages, although that's important, but they're standing up against a lying school board that's hiding the fact that they've squandered money, that they've privatized the schools. And this is a strike basically for the children. So I think people should look deeply into it. I think people should support the Solidarity Fund, and that's easy to find. Los Angeles Teachers Union, and look for their Strike Solidarity Fund. You can also donate to Tacos for Teachers, which I kind of love. It's a support striking teachers and bring taco trucks to the picket lines. Pretty exciting.
Bill Ayers is our guest. Bill Ayers joins us every Monday on this segment called Education for Liberation. Bill, you are starting to go on. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, the point is that this is a strike in Los Angeles, but it has national implications for schools, for the future of public education. And as usual in this round of struggles, they are not striking in any kind of small-minded, selfish way. They're striking for smaller class sizes. They're striking to have the arts in the schools. They're striking to put an end to the privatization of this wonderful public asset, which is public education. And the thing to remember is that Los Angeles has really rich people and really poor schools. And that's the contradiction that these teachers are walking into. Class sizes run as high as 46 in Los Angeles. And the school district declares a fiscal emergency. But LA schools have one nurse for every 1,200 students, one counselor for every 950 students, compared to 250 students recommended by the American School Counselors Association. So the strike is about something very serious, and that is the future of public education, the decency of recognizing that every kid, no matter the circumstances of their birth, deserves access to a fully funded, forward-looking, decent public school. And that's what the strike is all about.
Bill, I wanted to ask you kind of a political question at this point, too. Mayor Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, is being talked about as a possible 2020 presidential candidate. He had been hoping against hope that this strike just simply wouldn't happen. Has he taken any kind of a lead in trying to bring the two sides together? Has he said anything about funding for the teachers, about reducing class sizes, about hiring more nurses and counselors and librarians? What's his position been on this?
No, his position has been to duck. And I think that's an important point that you're bringing out. When people are lining up to run for president, we should look deeply at their records. It's not enough that they're charming and that they have an interesting background story. The important thing is, where have they stood on the issues of the day, whether that issue with public education or criminal justice? You look at Kamala Harris, who has many, many assets going for her as a candidate, but you look at her as District Attorney of San Francisco or Attorney General of California, she's part of the problem, not part of the solution. So I think it's important that we look at the mayor and say, what have you done? You actually have the power to step in here and use your good office as a bully pulpit at the very least, but he has not done that. And I think we should hold him accountable for that. But I think it's our job now to stand on the picket line in support of this very progressive, very forward-looking union as it struggles to not only survive as a group of teachers, but for the survival of public education in Los Angeles.
I want to share a few facts. What state has more poor children than any other?
Yeah.
That would be California.
Wealthy California.
Shocking when you think it's not Mississippi, it's not Alabama. That's one thing. The state of California spends about $74,000-$75,000 to house a single inmate per year. The Los Angeles education system spends $11,000 per student. So it's $74,000 to incarcerate prisoners, $11,000 to educate our kids in California.
I want everyone to underline that statistic because that speaks volumes and that tells us what social suicide looks like. Let's put all that money into incarceration. Let's steal money from the most vulnerable, from kids, from families. Let's take that money and spend it on incarceration. People should underline that and remember it as a metaphor for where we're headed as a society.
That's Bill Ayers. One more statistic. Governor Jerry Brown is using a surging $8.8 billion in surplus in his 16th and final year leading the state to stash billions of dollars in schools? No, in reserves. He wants to put all of the additional money, that's $7.6 billion of it at least, into two reserve funds that combined would hold $17 billion a year from now if trend holds, rather than providing money for schools and kids in Los Angeles. And there's a big surplus in LA too, by the way.
Wow.
Exactly. It's a very wealthy state. It's the fifth largest economy in the world if the state of California were a country. So the idea that they're somehow starving and they need austerity is absurd. But I want to draw your attention to one other thing, which is very similar. In Chicago, where the mayor proposed, I've mentioned this on the show before, but the mayor proposed a $95 million police academy in the wake of closing 50 schools, another recipe for social suicide. But the brilliant organizers from a group called hashtag No Cop Academy and Black Lives Matter have gone door to door in the neighborhood where this cop academy is proposed. And they've done absolutely brilliant work mobilizing the community by asking two simple questions. One is, if you had access to $95 million, what would you propose that we as a city do? And the second question, what would policing look like in a fair and democratic society? For those of us who care about education and the future of our country and the future of the world, we ought to be going door to door and asking people, what would a fair and decent and forward-looking school look like? Where do the privileged send their kids? I want to also add one other thing to change the subject slightly. Arne Duncan, who I often spend time railing against, tweeted the other day that it would be a disaster if the LA teachers went on strike because these kids deserve an education and the fights of grown-ups should not be visited on the children. This is the same Arne Duncan who sends his kid to a Tony private school, the same Arne Duncan who said that the parents should go on strike themselves until gun control legislation is passed. And so he's got a very selective idea of what one ought to do. But he is one of the architects of corporate school reform in its more benign face. So nobody should take that seriously. We are in a situation, a life and death struggle about the future of public education. The focal point today is Los Angeles. We should all pour our attention and our energy into supporting that righteous and important social movement, really, in the form of a work action, but it's actually a social movement.
Indeed it is. And the teachers did not want to strike.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That's often, you know, that's how the narrative gets spun, that somehow these selfish, bloated, you know, teachers who are somehow driving, you know, luxury cars and living in air-conditioned splendor are somehow robbing the people of Los Angeles. That's absolutely 180 degrees from the truth. When they show up in their 20-year-old Nissans,
yeah,
and, you know, have to work a second job just to make ends meet. And as you point out, California spends $10,000 per student on public education and $75,000+ on people in prison. It's an outrage.
Bill, what does your experience tell you about the fact that the schools are technically still open, using administrators and scabs to teach children? There's no indication yet. I mean, this is all so fresh. There's no indication that many students are crossing the picket lines to go back to school. But in your own personal experience, does that prolong a strike, or does that push the administrators or the school board back to the negotiating table? We have a little bit less than 1 minute left.
Okay. Well, I think that the strategy of the bosses is always the same. Let's try to keep the thing running. Let's try to do it with scab labor. Let's try to do it with administration. The reality is the kids in Los Angeles were not being given a full, wholesome, robust education before the strike. And now it's down to absolutely anemic non-education. The question that we will all watch unwind is, are the parents and the teachers united? I believe they are in Los Angeles. They were in Chicago. They were in West Virginia and Arizona. If the teachers and the parents are united, the people who run this system, the political class, the ruling class, don't have a chance.
That was the voice of Bill Ayers. Bill joins us every Monday to talk about education across the country. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of the book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. Check out his work at www.billayers.org. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
British Prime Minister Theresa May traveled around the country to drum up support ahead of Tuesday's critical parliamentary vote on Brexit. She told voters in Northern England that if Parliament votes down the Brexit deal, there will be no alternative, and it will paralyze British politics and likely lead to no Brexit. We're joined from London by Steve Headley. He's the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. Welcome back, Steve.
Well, thank you for the invite.
Steve, this vote is going to be close. What do you think the chances are that it does not pass Parliament?
Well, I disagree. I don't think it's going to be close. All the indications are that the vote isn't going to get past Parliament. And I think, looking back on it, there's a real possibility that we've been played for a year or so now since the Brexit vote was taken. I think that the Conservatives are going to say that Parliament is paralysed. There's no majority for anything, and they're going to push a people's vote. They're going to say they reluctantly have to go to a people's vote. But I think that's the way it's going to look, and the people's vote is going to be a second referendum, which I believe will come back with a slim majority to remain. I'm going to predict that now. I may well be wrong, but I think that's the way it's going to go.
Wow. That would be just monumental, wouldn't it?
We stopped making predictions, Steve, after the November 2016 election. So, yeah, if that were to happen, what will the political fallout be, say, within the broader British public, mm-hmm. and also especially with those who voted to leave? It will occur to them and seem to them that they voted, and they voted the wrong way from the point of view of what the political and business elites wanted. And as a consequence, they're just going to have a second vote until finally the vote turns out the way the elites want them. No?
Well, the European Union have got form on this. When Ireland voted twice, they reject the Maastricht Treaty and another treaty. I can't remember which one it was, but they just had another vote until they got what they wanted. So I think if they do that over here at the minute, they're going to really reap the whirlwind. Already you've got far-right groups jumping on board, calling for saying that there's been a Brexit betrayal, there's about to be a Brexit betrayal. And these sort of semi-fascist groups are already attacking picket lines, attacking left-wing demonstrations. And I believe, in a way, that they're useful fools. They've been set up by the government, because if they become the face of Brexit, then many decent people will distance themselves from the whole project. But there will be an awful backlash if Brexit isn't carried out. People will feel that the democratic system is democratic in name only, and that the ruling class, if they don't get their way, will just scupper democracy, use it when it suits them, and get rid of it when it doesn't suit them.
Steve Headley is our guest. Steve is talking to us from London. Steve Headley is the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. John, we've been following this issue on Loud and Clear for, well, since the referendum.
Since
before in June 2016. And Steve Headley was one of our guests back then, along with other folks, including Alex Gordon and others. And they constituted, you, Steve Headley, constituted what was called Lexit, meaning the left-wing forces who were against remaining inside the EU. There was, of course, the right-wing forces who were emphasizing immigration and keeping non-Brits out of the UK. But you were emphasizing something different, which is that the EU structures in the European Union institutional power was such that even when working class people within their own sovereign borders were able to fight for and cause politicians to create some reforms, that those could be overruled by central authorities, by central bureaucracies who are accountable to no one. Is that what the essence of your opposition was, or can you explain a little bit more what Lexit meant to you and to other progressives?
Well, absolutely. If you look at what happened in Greece, Greece is a prime example. You had a government who was elected on an anti-austerity program, a so-called left-wing government in Syriza. And what happened was the European Union threatened to cut off the country's finances. The Trochia, the World Bank, the European Union, and the IMF simply said, if you go ahead with any of these anti-austerity measures, if you don't do exactly what we tell you, we're going to destroy your country financially. So that's the power of the European Union in a nutshell. We already see in France what the liberalisation of the railways. We told people this was going to happen, the European Fourth Rail Bill, which makes it compulsory that private firms can tender for any contract within the European Union. We have most European Union countries now have state-run railways, but they're going to bring the private sector in there. They're going to do that in all spheres. I mean, this is just the start of it. They're going to bring the private sector in and open up markets for capitalists that were previously closed off. They were previously nationalized markets. And that is the crux of the European Union. If you just look at the European Union's constitution, I mean, this isn't me. This isn't my opinion. This is what's actually written down. It emphasizes it's a liberal free market. It emphasizes the free movement of capital. It emphasizes the free movement of labor. And by the way, we're not against immigration, but what our form of immigration and their form of immigration are completely different. What they want to do is use people, they make them forced immigration across Europe, not pay them the rates of pay, but super exploit them in a country where they can get a job and not in their own country. So we're against all of that. We welcome people. We're in the transport industry. We welcome immigrants coming here, but they've got to be on the same terms and conditions and money as people who work in Britain.
That's Steve Headley. Steve, again, we saw the Yellow Vest movement in France compelling Macron under extreme pressure from the street, from the radical movement, to make economic concessions. And immediately we heard from EU bureaucrats that Macron may not, in fact, be able to grant such concessions because it would violate budgetary discipline from imposed on France or any sovereign from the EU. Another example, no?
Absolutely. And what you have, you have the unelected bureaucracy of the European Union dictating to a national state. I mean, I'm not any friend of Macron. I think he's an absolute embodiment of the neoliberalism and globalization agenda. Not any friend of his, but at the end of the day, he's been elected by the French people to run their country. Now, what they're saying to the French government is, we don't care who's elected you. We don't care what the French people say. We in the European Union are going to tell you what they do. And that, to me, is completely unacceptable.
I want to ask also, getting back to the bill that's before Parliament now, in the very beginning, Brexit was supposed to aid the National Health Service. It was supposed to inject so much money into the National Health Service that it would repair it and make it the way it was originally intended. That's never happened. So what would this final Brexit bill do for Britons?
Well, the final Brexit bill that's on the table at the minute is an absolute dog's dinner. It's going to do nothing for Britain. In fact, it's going to keep Britain locked within a lot of the mechanisms of the European Union without even having any say at the table. The money that was going to be put to the NHS, that would only be done under a Labour government. That was never going to happen under a Conservative government. They don't care about the NHS. They never have cared about the NHS. So that was always just a red herring that they threw in. But really, the situation is Theresa May has come up with a deal that satisfies absolutely nobody. The Irish backstop has yet to be sorted out. The DUP are still not happy, so that's our coalition partners, very right-wing party from the north of Ireland. They're still not happy. So the deal, unless barring a miracle, the deal is not going to go through. And then that will give her a perfect excuse to go back to the country and say, well, look, we can't get a majority in Parliament for anything. We'll let the people decide, hence the people's vote.
If that doesn't happen, Steve, if there's no appetite for a second referendum, or if it doesn't pass, not pass, but if it doesn't, if it's not held, if the vote itself isn't held, do you still see the possibility of a new general election and the possibility of Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour Party taking the prime ministership?
Well, I mean, that would be the preferential outcome for everybody. I think if Jeremy Corbyn was leading the Brexit negotiations after winning a general election. And I mean, to be quite honest, anything's possible now at the minute, but one thing's for sure, unless there's massive change in the next 24 hours, that Brexit bill is going down.
Steve, you mentioned a minute ago the Irish backstop. In the press, at least the press that we're seeing here, they're telling us that nothing really has been settled with the Irish backstop. We have 1 minute left. Can you talk about what would end up happening to that border, either with a deal or without a deal?
Well, the Good Friday Agreement says that there should be no hard border between the north and the south of Ireland. And that's a deal that's been reached and kept peace in Ireland for a considerable period of time. Now you've got a dilemma where the south of Ireland is within the European Union. They're not coming out. The north of Ireland will be forced to come out of the European Union, even though they voted against. That was one of the regions that voted against Brexit. And we're going to have a position where you have to have, if to maintain the any sort of customs to stop goods going from one place to another, you're going to have some way of calculating that tariff. So that would mean some sort of border. But to be quite honest, the fact is that there's a border there at the minute anyway. And people have to realise just because that border is invisible doesn't mean it's not there. And I think it might wake some Irish people up out of their dream world where they believe that there's no border. And they might actually do something to get rid of the border permanently.
Okay, that was the voice of Steve Headley, who joined us from London. Steve is the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.